Okay.
This court now resumes its session.
And so for Mr. Tree will be for the appellant, and for the government we have Mr. Stuckey. Okay, Mr. Tree, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Miss Alderson's parents divorced when she was a young child. Miss Alderson experiences significant guilt due to her feelings her parents' arguments were because of her. She had a long history of abuse, including witnessing violence between her parents, enduring physical and emotional abuse herself, having a knife thrown at her by her father, being sexually abused by an adult male relative. She has been diagnosed and treated with post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, and depression. She has difficulty sleeping throughout the night, has nightmares. Yes, Your Honor.
Could you hold on for a minute?
Certainly.
Could you lift up one hand? Because I think your screen is frozen. We have the IT. Okay. Okay. Now I see it. No, it's not. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Miss Alderson has difficulty sleeping throughout the night, has nightmares. She has many triggers that cause her to relive her trauma. She suffers from panic attacks, and she often isolates herself. The ALJ found she, in fact, did have severe depression and anxiety. When Miss Alderson was in school during elementary school, she was in special education, and she had an individual education plan called an IEP. She was tested by a school psychologist and found she had a full-scale IQ of 78. Her cumulative grade point average in high school was 1.5. She was unable to pass any of the Washington State minimum testing standards in reading, writing, and math, and did not graduate from high school. She had head injuries with associated concussion and loss of consciousness, and she suffers from cognitive impairments. In addition, the administrative law judge found that she suffered from 10 different severe physical impairments. These include severe double-jointed hips, sacroiliac joint dysfunction, ligament impairments, polyarthralgia, chronic pain, chronic headaches, of the migraine sort, asthma, morbid obesity, obstructive sleep apnea, and chronic fatigue. Dr. Schultz performed an independent psychological exam for the Social Security Administration. He was SSA's expert consultative examiner. He found that Ms. Alderson would not be consistent in attendance at work if she were working at ER 553. The vocational expert testified that a person that misses more than one day of work per month would be unable to sustain any unskilled work. The ALJ gave SSO's own independent medical examiner little weight for three reasons, none of which are specific and legitimate, let alone clear or convincing. First, because Dr. Schultz stated that Anderson had an IEP, This was really confusing to me. The ALJ says, I discredit Dr. Schultz because Dr. Schultz said that she had an IEP, but he didn't review the educational records. But she did have an IEP. The judge knew it. It's in the record. It's in the educational records. It also was testified to by Dr. Rubin, who the ALJ gave full weight to, great weight to, and he testified exactly to the same thing. So if Ms. Alderson had lied to Dr. Schultz and said she had an IEP when she didn't, and the record showed she didn't, that would be a reason to discredit him and Ms. Alderson. But Ms. Alderson told the truth. She did have an IEP. There's no reason to discredit Dr. Schultz based on an accurate and truthful statement.
I guess I took the ALJ's point there to be not so much that 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 was evidence of an error on Dr. Schultz's part, because as you say, she did indeed have an IEP, but the fact that he hadn't reviewed the educational records means that, you know, the mere fact that there was an IEP doesn't really tell you anything about what the person's disability was or what the person's condition was. And so I think what the ALJ was trying to say is, given that he didn't look at the educational records, the inference is that he was overly reliant on her own subjective report of her condition. So can you address that idea?
The ALJ's, I agree, the ALJ's point was he didn't see the IEP, but she did have an IEP, and he said that his cognitive, his limitations that he gave were discredited because he relied on her having an IEP without actually seeing the school records. Well, his limitation regarding attendance was clearly based on social limitation, not cognitive limitations. The cognitive limitations had to do with learning new tasks, and Dr. Schultz clearly made that point. So it didn't have any, it wasn't relevant to the issue of attendance, which was based on the social limitations. Second, he may have had the educational records. The ALJ assumes he didn't. Here's the evidence in the record that shows he may, very well may have had the educational records, is because this was an evaluation that was requested by the state agency at the initial level of the application process. Typically, they'll turn over educational records to a consultant, psychological consultant. The record shows they had received the educational records prior to the doctor's evaluation. So it would be standard practice to turn it over to him. The doctor mentioned what medical records he had reviewed. He didn't mention if he'd reviewed any other function reports that they typically give to the doctor or any other educational records. So he had some pretty good detail about the IEP, which is consistent with the educational records. So we don't know for sure that he didn't have the educational records.
Well, Ms. Alderson is only, what, 24 years old right now?
Yes.
Now, this is about the youngest applicant I've ever had in my experience looking for disability. It sounds to me like maybe your best case may be related to a lack of a second psychological exam. It was requested. Dr. Rubin recommended it, but the ALJ turned that request down by Ms. Alderson's counsel. Is that a big point or not a big point in your opinion?
I think it's a very big point, a very significant point, because the ALJ said, I give great weight to Dr. Rubin. ALJ didn't reject anything that Dr. Rubin said. As you stated, multiple times during his testimony, he asked for a consultative examination. He basically was crediting Dr. Schultz and said that he agreed with Dr. Schultz's limitations regarding attendance deficits, but that was in 2016. When she first applied. It was now 2018 when the ALJ held his hearing, and he said, I don't have any functional limitations for 2018. I need a consultative exam to be able to give a full opinion here. And he said furthermore regarding that my mind went blank here. That is a very important point, Your Honor.
Does the record reflect any reason why the ALJ denied a second psychological exam?
It does. At the hearing, the ALJ stated, Dr. Rubin requested it, and then the attorney, I wasn't the attorney at the hearing, but the attorney at the hearing then asked the ALJ, Your Honor, we would request a consultative exam as Dr. Rubin had indicated, and the ALJ said, request denied. I find this claimant is very capable and that she can work. I deny your request. Well, that's troubling, because Dr. Rubin said, yeah, I agree with Dr. Schultz, but now it's 2018. Maybe she should try to work, and I don't know if she'd be successful in working, but she should try to work. Dr. Rubin didn't know that she had actually had tried to work. She was working part-time and doing very poorly at it. She was informed by her counsel at the hearing. Dr. Rubin, or the counsel told Dr. Rubin, hey, she is working. And Dr. Rubin lit up and said, oh, how's that going? And the ALJ wouldn't allow the attorney to explain how it was going, but the record showed it was going very poorly and the job ended because of stress, and that she wasn't able to do it. She'd lost focus and was unable to do it. So she had tried, and that's what Dr. Rubin wanted to see. You gotta have a try if you actually can do it or not.
Counsel, did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal? I see your time is up, but I'll give you a minute for rebuttal anyway.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, so now we'll hear from the government, please.
Good morning. I'm Shada Stuckey, appearing on behalf of the Commissioner of the Social Security Administration. We ask the court to affirm the judgment of the district court because substantial evidence supports the administrative law judge's findings and her conclusion that Ms. Alderson was not disabled under the Social Security Act. Ms. Alderson challenges the ALJ's assessment of the medical opinion evidence addressing mental limitations. But of the four medical opinions on this matter, the ALJ rejected only one and provided valid reasons for doing so. The ALJ then assessed a residual functional capacity that aligned with the opinions of two state agency doctors and a medical expert who reviewed the record and testified at the administrative hearing. All of these doctors opine that Ms. Alderson could work if the work was limited, consistent with the ALJ's findings, to simple tasks and routine work and limited social interactions. In other words, the ALJ relied on medical opinions that came later in time, those of Dr. Brown and Dr. Gilbert and Dr. Rubin. These doctors had a greater opportunity to review the record. The ALJ's assessment was reasonable and should be affirmed.
Could you address the point that Judge Gilman raised earlier, which is that the ALJ has a duty to develop the record, and here the most recent psychological exam was, I think, a couple of years before. Dr. Rubin, on who the ALJ relied, said there should be another one. Why shouldn't the ALJ have directed that there be another exam?
So here, the record was thoroughly developed in this case. It contained the results of a psychological consultative exam, as you pointed out, from September 2016. And this was well within the period of alleged disability that began on June 2016. Then there were two state agency psychological medical consultants that offered opinions regarding Ms. Alderson's mental health limitations, one of whom reviewed and commented on the consultative exam findings from September 2016. And then, having reviewed these documents, the ALJ went even a step further and arranged to have this psychological medical expert review the entire record and provide opinions at Ms. Alderson's hearing. So with this substantial development of the record, Ms. Alderson fails to establish it was ambiguous or inadequate to allow for proper evaluation, and that's the standard for these matters.
Well, let me ask you this. In 2016 was that psychological examination. She tried to commit suicide in 2017, didn't she?
Yes.
She was hospitalized.
That's true.
Well, I mean, that seems to me, well, that was a fairly significant event that might need a psychological update.
Right. The ALJ specifically addressed that in her opinion at ER 19. She noted that there was an emergency room visit for a suicide attempt in December 2017. And then she emphasized that the suicide attempt was situational and the result of a single depressive episode. And
so that was per Ms. Alderson's mother who said that.
It
doesn't seem consistent with the record, because the record seems to show that she's had suicidal tendencies since she was 13 years old.
Well, when she went to the hospital, she did report, there's a note, I think, at ER 629 from that emergency review visit that does cite a breakup or maybe romantic problems or something as the reason for the suicide attempt. Also, you know, the month before that suicide attempt, she had weaned herself off her medications and reported that her depression was stable. And then she was seen in the emergency room for that suicide attempt in December 2017, which, as you note, Your Honor, her mother did cite the recent breakup as the only reason for that suicide attempt.
She had other cuttings. She had been cutting herself several years before that, hadn't she?
Well, I wasn't sure if the cutting was from that particular suicide attempt or from, I thought it was from that attempt. I thought that the cuttings were a reference only to that one emergency room visit.
It seems to me the record has some evidence of her having these suicidal attempts and other tendencies well before this 2017.
If you look at the period for which she's alleging disability, it's a 2-year period, I think June 2016 through July 2018. She's doing moderately well. I mean, the ALJ does account for several impairments in the RFC, but she's alleging that she couldn't work at all, even with significant accommodations. And even if you look at the work that she was doing, Mr. Tree has pointed to, you know, she was working at an auto auction. This is discussed in the record at ER 54 and was having difficulties. But when the ALJ specifically asked her, you know, how's it going? She said, oh, you know, I'm really tired. She complained of physical problems. She was walking 5 hours, I think, a day. And that was too much walking. And then the ALJ limited her to 2 hours per day in the RFC. But she doesn't say anything about more social, cognitive problems at this job. And again, if you look at ER 552, this is, I think, Dr. Schultz's psychological evaluation where the claimant talks about a job at Labor Ready. She says, you know, I couldn't stand is part of the problem with working at Labor Ready, and she could not be around people. Well, that problem with being around people also was accommodated in the RFC. So I think what you see here is, yes, she had problems, but the ALJ accommodated very, very significant problems in the RFC. And I would like to go back to Dr. Rubin's opinion. Because I think that the way that basically what he was saying, and I think this is very telling and sort of sets the tone for the entire record, is that, you know, he said, yes, I see Dr. Schultz has noted attendance problems. Again, Dr. Schultz actually didn't specify any specific days that would be missed. It was some vague sort of reference to attendance problems based on social issues. But Dr. Rubin then said there might be some motivational factors at play. He then went on to note that Ms. Alderson, who was only 19 years old when she applied for disability, would benefit from work. It would help with her self-esteem and self-worth and make her feel more like an adult and more functional than staying home. He also proposed limitations that would lower the hurdles to working, such as work without complex tasks or a high pace or high stress or contact with the public. And the ALJ incorporated restrictions that aligned with these opinions. The ALJ was the fact finder at the hearing who had the opportunity to hear from Dr. Rubin in person. And her interpretation of Dr. Rubin's statements was reasonable and provides no basis for remand in this case. Regarding Dr. Brown's opinion, Dr. Brown stated that Ms. Alderson was not disabled after opining that she had limitations similar to the limitations noted by Dr. Rubin. His opinion also does not provide a basis for remand. Dr. Gilbert, his opinion emphasized that Ms. Alderson remained capable of simple tasks with reasonable concentration, pace, and persistence, attending work within customary tolerances, working within a routine and completing a normal work day and work week. And the ALJ incorporated limitations that aligned with this opinion. In the briefing, Ms. Alderson focuses on, you know, the first half of one sentence in Dr. Gilbert's opinion that mentions occasional difficulties when symptomatic. But the opinion does not state that Ms. Alderson is always symptomatic. And the second half of that same sentence provides more detail and states that Ms. Alderson can work with the limitations incorporated in the residual functional capacity and could complete a normal work day and work week. So again, you know, this is a case where the ALJ harmonized these three consistent medical opinions that all pointed to the same conclusion about Ms. Alderson, you know, who was a young person, still a bit unsettled, as is typical at age 19. She was coming to terms with adulthood and had difficulties, but she could work. And in fact, work may be part of the solution to her problems, as Dr. Rubin suggested. The ALJ's decision was reasonable and should be affirmed. Turning to Dr. Schultz, the ALJ gave several valid reasons for discounting Dr. Schultz's opinion. And Ms. Alderson appears to suggest that the ALJ should have adopted additional cognitive and social limitations based on Dr. Schultz's report. But again, the residual functional capacity accounts for significant cognitive and social limitations. And to the extent Ms. Alderson argues that the ALJ erred by not adopting even greater social and cognitive limitations, it is difficult to see how Dr. Schultz's vague opinion would support greater limitations when it was so unspecific. I see that I am over time. And so if there are no further questions, you know, we ask the court to affirm because the ALJ's decision was supported by substantial evidence.
Counsel, you're just slightly over your time, but if you need another minute or two for your argument, you can have it.
I don't have anything more, Your Honor. I would be happy to answer questions.
Okay. Any questions from Judge Miller or Judge Gilman? Okay. No questions. Now we'll permit rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. The interestingly, as we spoke of previously, Dr. Rubin requested a consultative exam. He also said she should try work. He didn't say she could work. He said she should try work and see if she could do it. He was very interested to find out she was actually trying it, and Dr. Rubin asked the question, how is she doing? That was not allowed to be answered. So Dr. Rubin didn't have that information that she was doing very poorly in work, which is clearly in the record. Dr. Rubin, though, says, I can't tell what her functioning is in 2018 without an updated psychological evaluation. We need to have one. When asked to do so by Ms. Alderson's counsel, the ALJ said, and this is at ER 68, it is my opinion that she's very capable based on this record. I deny the request. Well, that's quite inconsistent with what's in the briefing from the commissioner in their brief. They said, yeah, she does have significant problems. There are extensive postural, environmental, mental, and social limitations. Quite contrary to what the ALJ found at the conclusion of the hearing, that she's capable based upon this record.
Okay, counsel, I'm afraid you're over your extended time, and so if you can, please wrap up your argument.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I guess I'd just like to say that what the ALJ said, that she had improved with treatment, but at best she waxed and waned with treatment. She, at the beginning, she was depressed, she was vomiting due to stress, she was lashing out, she was tired. Her motivation, her doctor said, wasn't because she was lazy, it was secondary to her depression, a common and a hallmark symptom of depression, lack of motivation.
Thank you, Your Honor. Be like the former Chief Justice Rehnquist and cut you off in mid-sentence, but to be fair to both sides, we've got to stay close to our times.
Okay. I understand. Thank you.
So I thank counsel, Mr. Tree, Ms. Stuckey. You've both made great arguments and for your clients, and we appreciate that. And again, we recognize it's difficult, even be hazardous, to be an advocate in the time of coronavirus. So thank you for that. At this point, Alderson v. Saul shall be submitted, and the parties will hear from the panel in due course. I think the next case on our argument calendar is McKinney-Drobnis. Okay. For the appellant, we have Trenton Kashima. And for the objector appellant, we have Adam Schulman. And then for Massage Envy, we have Theodore Boutrous. Now, let me ask, have the counsel for the appellant and the objector agreed on the timing?
Counsel, this is, sorry, Your Honor, this is Trenton Kashima, counsel for the plaintiff's appellees. Actually, me and Mr. Boutrous have also agreed to split our times equally in arguing against the objector.
Okay. I'm afraid this was only set for 15 minutes per side. I might somewhat arbitrarily say we'll change it to 20 minutes per side so that each of you can have 10 minutes. It's sort of hard to make an argument in 7.5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, well, please proceed. So the appellant, I guess, is Mr. Schulman. Am I failing?
Good morning, Your Honors.
So we're to say you also get an extra 5 minutes. So you can take 20 minutes.
Since I'm against two appellees, I'll probably reserve a significant chunk for rebuttal, if that's fine.
That's fine.
Good morning, Your Honors. Adam Schulman for Objector Appellant Kurt Orshak. Cases are better decided on reality than on fiction. Economic reality determines whether a consumer class action settlement may be approved as fair, reasonable, and adequate under Rule 23E. And where the economic value is opaque, this court, most recently in Rose v. SFBSC Management, and in Chambers v. Whirlpool, and in Briseño v. Henderson, has charged district courts with an obligation to investigate further and to develop the record to support its ultimate valuation. But instead of holding the settling parties to their burden here, the district court simply accepted the settlement voucher's full face value as the proper measure of class value. And that's a twofold error. First, it contravenes the Class Action Fairness Act, which dictates that class value in a coupon settlement is determined by the value of those coupons that are redeemed by class members. Second, it contravenes Rose, which holds that regardless of whether a settlement qualifies as a CAFA coupon settlement, it must be closely scrutinized and realistically appraised. Here, the economic reality is that class counsel has negotiated a fee for themselves of 2 to 4 times the probable recovery of their clients, the absent class members, and they negotiated a reversionary structure so that the class cannot benefit from the more than $600,000 reduction to their unopposed and insulated fee. Yet the district court remained untroubled, stating that, well, they won't be paid if they're not paid. That's ER 69. But that sentiment writes the $3.3 million clear sailing fee entirely out of the constructive common fund, or in the words of Bluetooth, quote, by disregarding the contents of the clear sailing provision here, the district court effectively deleted it from the settlement, an approach that is beyond the scope of the district court's discretion, end quote. So both Rule 23 and CAFA require reversing the approval of this settlement, and I welcome the panel's questions.
So starting with CAFA, we have, I believe, avoided saying what the standard of review is in assessing a district court's determination as to whether something is a coupon settlement. Why isn't that the sort of, you know, fact-specific analysis that we would review with some measure of deference?
We view it as a question of statutory interpretation of what coupon means in 1712. We're not here challenging any of the factual bases that the parties put forward. We're not challenging that this instrument can purchase 150 different products, and we're not challenging that it can be aggregated or transferred. We're not challenging the facts. The only question is whether, given those facts, whether the standard of law in the district court's interpretation of Easy Saver and of online DVD was the correct one. That's the question before Your Honors.
But I mean, I guess
the district.
The
district court held that these vouchers were not coupons under what the online DVD factors. And I thought the key fact of what makes something a coupon is the customer has to spend more money with the defendant to use a coupon. Well, here that isn't true. With the voucher, they can buy, what, as you say, 150 products of Massage Envy without paying anything. So why is the district court error in holding these vouchers do not equal coupons under CAF?
Well, there's two reasons. First of all, if you look at online DVT at page 952, the court disclaims the idea that being able to purchase a product is enough. It says that those gift cards were not coupons because it was not merely that they could purchase a whole product, but they could purchase a variety of products. So that's the first point. The second point is if that was the decisive factor, then Easy Saver, it's inconsistent, and Easy Saver you'd have to say was wrongly decided, because in Easy Saver they could purchase 15 to 25 products, and it was. And the court held that essentially because the instrument was not a cash equivalent, it was not within the realm of the giant universe of products available, like at Walmart.com, that the only logical conclusion would that they were a coupon. So in our view, the test is not just a balancing test where because if the test is a balancing test, you're gonna continue to see inconsistent district court opinions interpreting online DVD as sort of you have in the past few years. But rather, in our view, is all three factors need to weigh in favor of considering the instrument to be a non-coupon before the narrow exception.
Do you have any law to support your position that all three have to be in your favor? Or
No, that's an issue of first impression, admittedly, but I think that's the only way that you could reconcile that decision with Easy Saver itself and the outcome in Easy Saver. And that's how, so for example, the whole product idea, if you look at what the Fourth Circuit did in Lumber Liquidators, a case that specifically looked at the three-factor test of Easy Saver, in that case, hundreds of flooring related products were available, but again, it wasn't, they could be purchased for that. I believe the coupon in that case was a face value of $700 or so. So there were a bunch of products, but they were all within that specific niche of flooring related products. Just like in this case, they're within the spa related spa accessory basket. They're not a general use product that's fungible for cash.
Is there anything in the record, and maybe this is more of a question for Mr. Boutros, but is there anything in the record about, I mean, I think I saw something about the number of products that are available and the total volume of sales of these kinds of, there's various tangible things like bottles of lotion and whatnot that you might buy at the locations. Is there anything in the record that indicates, how many of these are actually available at any given location, and also, how the volume of sales of these items relates to the volume of sales of the more expensive services that are being provided. Essentially, what I'm asking is, do the customers of Massage Envy, are they actually going there to buy, you know, the inexpensive, tangible things that you might buy for less than the price of the voucher, or are they mostly buying more expensive services that you couldn't get for a voucher?
Those are all great questions, and I don't believe there's record evidence that spoke to that, but I believe that it is the obligation of the district court under Rose and related case law to probe those questions and to supplement the record until the answers are known before approving the settlement. Because even if they, even if your honors don't want to reach the CAFA question, just as Rose didn't reach the ultimate CAFA question, there's an obligation of the district court to probe the economic reality.
Counsel, could you hold on a minute?
Yes.
Stacy.
Sure.
I see a clock, but the time is not running on it.
Judge Gould, this is Kwame. We're working on it.
Okay.
Technical difficulties.
Technical difficulties. That's what happens. Okay, we'll let the appellant continue his argument. And I guess we're going to have to be a little on the honor system here, counsel, that you have... ...20 minutes to argue, so you should stop when you're around that time and save any for rebuttal. We're operating with a frozen clock.
Okay. Now it's all right. Well, I just guess to continue my thought there, I was just saying that if your honors feel that the CAFA question is more difficult, certainly you could reserve that question and just decide on the 23E basis that that my client requested the district court inquire into the redemption rate in the Hahn settlement, which involved the same counsel, the defendant in the Southern District of California, which they had settled for a voucher relief, and to see what the redemption rate was there. And the district court did inquire into that, but then accepted that the representations from Mr. Kashima and defense counsel below that they weren't exactly sure what that rate was. And rather than require them to submit further evidence, she just approved it as if it was 100%, which was even their estimates were the high teens. So counsel, that was error.
Could I interject a question about something you said? You said maybe we could put CAFA aside and just decide the case on the Rule 23. And I take it you mean on the Bluetooth factors. If we were to do that and rule in your favor and vacate and remand, wouldn't the court below still have to address the coupon issue?
It would have to. We think that this court should lay out a test where if all three Bluetooth factors are present, then the settlement is presumptively invalid unless there's a sort of an extraordinary justification that the other side can present, which they haven't in their papers presented. So, for example, one such justification might be like the facts of the Campbell decision, where the plaintiffs tried to certify the class under B3 and were rejected in a litigated decision, and could only settle as a B2, and they settled without impairing at all the monetary rights of absent class members, and the fees were sub-lodestar. So that would be an example of extraordinary circumstances that could potentially justify the presence of all three Bluetooth factors. But in an ordinary case, it would necessitate a conclusion that the settlement didn't satisfy Rule 23.
Now, let me ask you this. The Bluetooth factors go to the fairness of counsel's fee, don't they? As opposed to the fairness of the settlement as a whole.
They go to essentially what was later codified under Rule 23E2C3, which is whether, which is this class's benefits in light of the attorney's fee. So that is to say, Bluetooth understood that you couldn't set, you couldn't consider them independently. The settlement was all in an entangled whole. It was a constructive common fund. So that the fee, a disproportionate share of the fee to the attorney means a disproportionately small share of the settlement to the class members.
Well, I mean, yeah, but I can see where the overall settlement might be found fair, but just the allocation of how much of that settlement goes to the attorneys versus the class members needs to be adjusted.
Well, certainly you could view it as, you could have an aggregate sum that's adequate to dispense with the class's claims. And we're not challenging here that $4.5 or $5 million, whatever the actual value is adequate to justify the global release. It's only a question of allocation where the fee award comes into play.
Right, right. Let me ask you this. You know, I'm curious what your response is to the 28J letter dated May 14 by Mr. Boudreaux, where he talks about that the average value of this settlement is nearly 90% of the average injury to each class member. And, you know, I noticed in the reply brief of Massage Envy, they say the average value of the claim vouchers is $94.61, almost 90% of the average fee increase each class member paid $106.25. Do you challenge the accuracy of those numbers, or is that okay?
Thank you for giving me an opportunity. That is actually one thing that I did want to speak to. I do challenge the notion that it could in any legitimate sense be considered a windfall to provide more money to the class. So, for example, if you look at ER 66, that's where the district court made a finding that's not challenged, that the $10 million face value is only 7.5%, or to be precise, 7.7% of the amount of damages alleged damages at issue in the case. Then again, if you look at ER 91, you'll see testimony from the settlement administrator stating that only 34% of the claimants will receive a voucher in amount that is more than the increased membership fees. So, of course, there's only 6% of the class claimed at all, and only 34% will receive a voucher. So even if you said that the voucher is the exact equivalent to cash, then only 34% of those would be paid an amount that is equal to or more than the membership paid. My client, for example, paid $395 in increased membership fees and will receive a $180 voucher. That's at ER 94. So I don't think there's any legitimate sense that this court could find that there's a windfall by providing more relief to the class in this scenario. If there aren't any more questions, I'll reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
That's fine. And then we'll proceed with the appellee's arguments. Now, have the appellees, have they decided who's going first?
Yes, Your Honor. This is Mr. Boutrous, and we agreed I would go first. Thank you very much, representing Massage Envy. And just to start with Judge Gilman's question, Mr. Shulman did not dispute, and there's no dispute in the record, that 90%, that the $100 average is 90% of the total damages that the individual class members could have obtained for themselves. And it's undisputed that one-third of the class will be recovering more through these vouchers than they could have recovered if they had gone to trial and prevailed. So this is a great deal for these class members. These are valuable vouchers. To Judge Miller's question, there's not that granular level of evidence, but regarding the product selection, but there was no dispute below. Mr. Shulman and the objector did not challenge the fact that there were hundreds of products available, massages and other services, and these vouchers are valuable enough that you could get, I think, 2 hours of massages for $100 voucher. So this is real value. The economic reality that Mr. Shulman mentions is that these are real value, $10 million in value to the class members, that is almost approaching what they could have recovered in what's a very weak case on the merits, as the district court noted in a very thorough hearing, that the class sued for breach of contract, Massage Envy, which did not have contracts with the class members. The contracts were with the franchisees. So they had major hurdles, and there were different contracts and, you know, all sorts of issues they confronted. They had released these claims, we contend, in a prior case where Mr. Kashima and his colleagues represented the class, and these class members were members of that class. So they had all kinds of problems and got a significant recovery. And the district court considered all these facts and had held a lengthy hearing, addressed all the factors under Rule 23 as amended, carefully applied this court's decisions that apply heightened scrutiny, including Bluetooth, and in this court's words, considered the whole gestalt of the case and undertook the kind of holistic assessment that it was required to do, and determined that the settlement was fair, reasonable, and adequate as Rule 23E mandates. And the court acted well within its broad discretion and protected the absent class members, and this court should affirm. It's really, the court applied all the correct legal standards to the facts. As this court has said, the appellate review is extremely limited. And we just heard from Mr. Shulman, they're arguing that this court should reject prior decisions, should reject the three-part test in Easy Saver for a coupon, to now find that Bluetooth creates a bright line per se rule that invalidates settlement. That's not the rule of this circuit. And so the counsel, they did not apply these standards below. And if I can maybe start with, back up a bit here, Mr. Shulman mentioned that you could put aside the coupon issue and just look at Rule 23. The problem with that is that Mr. Shulman and the objector here made the same error that the objector in the Campbell versus Facebook case made. They only challenged one factor, the fees. And I counted up the factors this morning. If you combine Rule 23E's factors and subfactors and this court's overlapping standards, there's something like 15 factors. And this is a holistic, fact-based analysis that is a balancing. And that's something that is subject to highly deferential review on appeal. And the objector hasn't even tried. In fact, I think Mr. Shulman just admitted they're not challenging any of the factual findings or determinations by the district court here. So the other factors include the risks of litigation, not just the fee amount, but what were the risks to the class? And as I mentioned in response to Judge Gilman's question about the value, the risks were huge, that they would lose and get nothing. They might not even have been able to get a class certified. Yet they're getting almost full recovery because Massage Envy wants to make its customers and potential customers come back and wanted to put this matter behind it, even though the claims are baseless. So this is exactly the kind of settlement that this court's cases encourage. And in the Campbell versus Facebook case, the court said that a party couldn't meet its high burden, an objector, of showing a clear abuse of discretion if they only focused on a subset of the many factors that the district court was required to consider.
What is your response to Mr. Shulman's point that only 7.7% of the value has really been recovered here?
That's, Your Honor, not unusual. And here, I do want to make this distinction, and Mr. Shulman mentioned the Verseno case. It's really crucial. 7% claimed their compensation. So in the Verseno case, which came down last week, the fees were measured, and they were seven times the actual claimed amounts. Here, fees are 25% of the $10 million of claimed fees. So, in a class like this, as the district court found, that claim rate is not unusual. But the claim rate, because it was small, it was less, that increased the amount of the vouchers that the individual claimants would receive. So they got $10 million of value. That's the economic reality.
Well, that, and if I can just stop you there, that they got $10 million in face value of vouchers. The, I mean, a voucher for $100, like even if you're a regular Massage Envy customer, is worth less than $100 in cash. And isn't that something under Rose that the district court has to take account of?
Well, Your Honor, it's really not worth less unless we're talking about sort of, you know, some of the costs of going and handing it over. But a $100 voucher at Massage Envy, you could take it in and get $100 worth of products or services. And they were, the suite of products was available across 1,000 stores. And as I said, I don't have the exact product selection at each place, but something like $43 million in sales. So these were, as the district court found, they were valuable, they were saleable, transferable, so they had the value.
But we all know that there's a reason that plaintiff's counsel didn't get its fees paid in Massage Envy vouchers, right? Because the voucher is, I mean, you might lose it before you have a chance to spend it. You might not want to, you know, go there during the relevant period. The products that you might want to buy might not be available at the location near you. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why it's something. I mean, it may be a high number, but it's something less than 100% of face value, isn't it?
And it's still very valuable, Your Honor, even if you do some sort of rough discounting for that. But I think here, and again, that goes to the question, the economic reality of the value. And it's, this court's recognized these sorts of settlements where non-cash. I mean, people lose their checks. If they get a check for 15 cents, like in Briseño, they may not cash it. So there's that issue. And so there's a practical, functional, economic reality to look at here. And the bottom line is these are people, and maybe I'll segue to the coupon issue, because this, again, I think is really important. The objectors arguing that this court should throw out the three-part test of Easy Saver. And the district court recognized it's a sliding scale and a balancing test. It's highly factual, Judge Miller, as you mentioned. So even though we're applying a legal standard to facts, it's the kind of mixed question that the Supreme Court in the U.S. Bank case, this court and other cases have said, we could leave that to the district court to balance the flexibility of the coupons or the vouchers. And this goes to your point, Judge Miller. They're not a cash equivalent. The objectors arguing that unless they are a cash equivalent, they're a coupon under CAFA. That's not the test that this court has established. They don't challenge.
Judge Gould, if I can interject on this issue. Am I correct in thinking that the three-factor test for whether something's a coupon is the law of the circuit, so that our panel is bound to apply that unless we're relieved of that under the standard in Miller v. Gammy?
Exactly, Your Honor. And there's been no showing that there's been any sort of change from the Supreme Court or from the en banc court under Miller v. Gammy that would permit this court to create a new rule. The three-part test of Easy Saver, it's relatively new. It's only a few years old. Hasn't caused any problems. It gives parties flexibility to give significant value to class members in a significantly weak case. So this court is bound by Easy Saver. The objector seems to recognize that and suggests en banc review would be appropriate, but that's a question for another day. Right. And the district court applied the test.
Is the standard to review the application of that three-part test abuse of discretion? I don't see how a multi-factor test could be a de novo review.
Absolutely, Your Honor. We think it's really the quintessential sort of abuse of discretion type of inquiry, where the court's looking at three different standards, looking at the facts, balancing between them to get to that bottom line question of whether this is falls within the CAFA coupon standard. And I mentioned the U.S. Bank case from a couple years ago from the Supreme Court, where the court said where the inquiry of how the law applies to the facts is highly fact bound and balancing is involved. That's it's the that's an issue that the district court is just in a better position to resolve, subject to abuse of discretion review. And there's no challenge here that the court abused its discretion under Easy Saver.
Okay, counsel, let's assume the panel ends up agreeing with you and not with the appellant that the three-factor test applies and there's no abuse of discretion. We still have the issue whether Rule 23 is satisfied and Bluetooth. So my question related to that is, can you tell me why clear sailing provisions on attorney fees and why reverters back to the payer of the settlement are ever proper in a class action setting?
Well, Your Honor, I think this court has said, and in fact in the Briseño case, the most recent case that came down last week, said that those sorts of features can result in a fair, reasonable, and adequate settlement. And the Volkswagen case said the same thing. And so here, I'll just, from a practical standpoint, give you my take on how it works here. With respect to the reverter, it really wasn't, it's a bit of a misnomer, because the settlement was structured with the vouchers of $10 million as a floor, couldn't go below that, could go up to $30 million, and then a $3.3 million agreement that the Massage Envy would not challenge a fee request of $3.3 million or below. But it could challenge it above. And the clear sailing provision, it wasn't really clear sailing, it was up to that amount. And if the settlement claim rate had been higher, that amount could have been as low as 11% of the $30 million ceiling. So that here on the clear sailing, Massage Envy let the plaintiffs take their chance. It did so against the backdrop of knowing this court has set a 25% general benchmark. And dare I say, Massage Envy wasn't hoping that they would get the $3.3 million. There's a standard here that's well settled in the circuit, and the district court applied it to reduce the fees to 25%. And then just back to the reverter, Judge Gould, here, this wasn't a general pot of money where the 25% fees was coming away from the $10 million. It was on top of the $10 million. And so it just meant that Massage Envy didn't have to pay more than 25%, which is perfectly fair. So it allowed the parties to come to an accommodation under the close supervision of the district judge, who looked at these issues and then said, in light of all the factors, including a high value to the plaintiffs, $10 million. In Briseño, it was pennies on the dollar. It was the fee. I think the recovery was less than $1 million, and the fees were seven times that. And so this, at Bluetooth, there was no economic recovery, and the fee was $800,000. Here we have $10 million in value. Even if, and Judge Miller, we discount that slightly for purposes of this analysis, it's still highly valuable, usable, saleable for a wide array of products, very valued. That's the economic reality. And if the fees had gone above $3.3 million, Massage Envy could have objected, but it didn't, because the district court performed its fiduciary role of reducing the fees to an amount that hits right at the benchmark that this court has established. And maybe if I can make one last point on Bluetooth, again, Mr. Shulman and the objectors are arguing for a new rule, that those three factors should be not cautionary signs, and the district court applied them explicitly, but death knell for a class settlement. That would make it impossible to settle these class actions. Here, the class members got an extraordinarily fair deal. And I would just end with this before I hand it over to Mr. Kashima. At most, if the court found for some reason the fee arrangement should be looked at again, the settlement, as the court did in Easy Savers, Whirlpool, as the Fourth Circuit did in Lumber Liquidators, the court should uphold the settlement and only allow for recalculation of fees. We don't think that's necessary here. And would request that the court affirm, but we request that the court uphold the settlement, which is, as I said, a very, very positive deal for the class members. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Good morning. If it may please the court, Trenton Kashima on behalf of the plaintiff appellees. To answer Judge Gould's question first, the standard review here, of course, is whether the court, the district court below, applied the right legal standard and based its decision off a sufficient factual record. And if that is true, of course, the decision below shouldn't be displaced. And as was discussed by my colleague, Mr. Boutros, and recognized by the court, here the court applied the correct factors, whether we're looking at INRI online DVD, INRI Bluetooth, the Churchill factors, or even Rule 23E C3, as suggested by Mr. Shulman. And there's nothing to suggest that the record wasn't adequately, sufficiently developed in order for the district court to do so. Accordingly, the district court decisions below shouldn't be displaced, but should be affirmed. Now, addressing some of Mr. Shulman's points first, Mr. Shulman suggests, and the objector here suggests, that INRI online DVD isn't a three-factor test, but an exception test. Unless it's exactly like INRI online DVD, there is no exception to Section 1712 of CAFA, and it is a coupon. However, that's not the law that currently exists. They may wish to challenge that en bloc, but that's not the law that currently exists in the circuit, and it's not the law that the district court has to apply. Instead, it is bound by the INRI online DVD standard, which was further articulated in INRI Easy Saver. And the first factor of that test is whether class members have to hand over more money of their own money before they can take advantage of this credit. Now, Mr. Shulman suggests that it doesn't matter if you can buy a whole product. However, that's exactly what this factor was supposed to challenge. And indeed, in quoting that, he suggests that Lumber Liquidators holds that it doesn't matter if you can buy a full product. That's not the test here. But if we actually look at INRI Lumber Liquidators, the point that the court made in that particular case is the product that's most likely going to be bought from Lumber Liquidators is flooring. Now, you can't replace a floor with $703, the average amount of the credits applied. And so, of course, people in that case would have to shell over more money in order to use the credit. However, here, the record is actually rich with the information that Judge Miller asked about. If we look at the supplemental excerpts of the record, plaintiff supplemental excerpts of the record, specifically Jeffrey Prince's declaration in support of fees. And sorry, it doesn't have a page number on it, but this document's the last document in the supplemental excerpt. And at paragraph 69 and 70, we specifically provide information regarding how much sales there were in 2018, the year before the settlement, of the products that were being offered by Massage Envy and how much the requested relief could actually purchase there. Additionally, we provided information regarding all the different services that could be purchased without additional outlay of money. And if we look at Exhibit B of that same declaration, not only did we provide a more general overview, we actually provided a list of all the different products that could be purchased. And was this information that the district court was actually looking at? Now, in the end, what could be purchased at Massage Envy with these coupons was actually disclosed to the court.
I think you mean to say vouchers.
Sorry, the vouchers.
Yeah, well, but that, I think that gets to a question I was going to ask, which is, we obviously, we're bound by online DVD and our elaboration of that in Easy Saver. But it seems like this your application of the test is getting us pretty far from the ordinary. I mean, we have a statute, right? And the statute uses the word coupon. And aren't we getting pretty far from the ordinary meaning of the word coupon, which seems like it comfortably encompasses a voucher that, you know, gives you some amount of money off of, you know, products that you purchase, you know, at a retailer that sells a fairly narrow range of products.
No, not at all. And actually, In Re DVD specifically addresses this. In Re DVD, the court held that gift cards and credits of these type are expressly distinct in the common parlance and also in everyday use from coupons. Gift cards and credits usually allow the purchaser to use it like cash. And I think that goes to the next portion of this, of the argument that Mr. Shulman makes, is the economic reality. Is the economic reality that the vouchers provided provide real relief to the class? And the answer to that is yes. Now, in arguing against the settlement, Mr. Shulman suggests that the attorney's fees are disproportionate to the value of the vouchers because we don't know what the vouchers were actually redeemed. However, when we look at what the settlement provides, we look at the value actually being provided to the class. And in Re DVD, when they decided that the gift cards, the Walmart gift cards in question weren't coupons, they assigned them their face value when approving the attorney's fees award of 25% of the common fund of $27,250,000, which represents the common fund, including the coupons. And the reason they did this is they recognized that the coupons provided real value. And the items that could be bought at Walmart are items that these individuals would be normally buying. So by displacing the dollar that they have to take out of their pocket, they're providing actually a real dollar in return. Now, what's important to note is the class here is predicated on the fact that these individuals signed a 12-month agreement to get massages, at least one massage a month. And so these are people that do regularly use massage services and the types of products and services offered at Massage Envy. And so by providing them these vouchers, we are also doing the same thing. We are displacing a dollar that they would be regularly spending on services that they regularly get and providing a dollar for them in return. Now, if we look at some of the other cases that were cited in the brief, we can see why this economic reality test sometimes states that, no, you shouldn't look at the face value. If we look at the Allen versus Bedella, in that case, there was no floor, like in this case, of how much could be claimed. And when the claims actually came in, they found out that only $373,000 of the settlement funds were distributed. And this is despite the fact that counsel there wanted a $1.25 million fee. Now, in this case, we don't have that same issue because we do know what the face value of the vouchers that were actually claimed in this dispute. And it's slightly less than $10 million. Additionally, if we look at Rose versus Deja Vu, which is also cited by the objector, it's the same type of fuzzy math. Plaintiff's counsel in that case was trying to claim credit for vouchers, in that case, dance credits, that weren't actually paid out. Indeed, the dance credits in that case, only 75 class members claimed them. And even though they could go up to, and they got credit for $1 million, the amount that was actually paid out to the dancers or assigned to the dancers was $370,000. And even there, because it was contingent on them working in the future, it wasn't really known if that actually represents a real value. And this court stated that the district court below should have probed more into that. Again, we don't have that issue here. There is no problem that the class members in our settlement will have in using these vouchers, simply because they're not dependent on a condition precedent continuing to work for defendant. They can go to any one of 12,000 massage envies across the nation and just simply use them. If we look at the Brazino versus Henderson case, the same results apply. Is class counsel there was trying to claim credit for a multi-million dollar settlement. However, there was no floor in that settlement. And when the claims came in, it was found that the amount actually paid out was a lot less than they were suggesting. In that case, too, they were also trying to claim credit for prospective relief that didn't look to have much value. So if you look at the cases where there's criticism about the true economic value, it's these deficiencies, these mathematical simple errors where the reality of the settlement and the amount actually given to the class doesn't match the reality of what was actually suggested and sold in the settlement agreement. Now, if there's no further questions, we would submit.
Any questions from Judge Gilmour or Judge Miller? Hearing no questions, we thank you for your argument. We'll return to Mr. Shulman, who has a hefty amount of rebuttal time, but I hope we can address some of the issues raised.
Thank you, Your Honor. There were a lot of points bandied about there, and I hope to respond to them all, or at least the crucial ones. So I guess I'd start with the CAFA discussion that's going on, and Mr. Kashima said that we don't dispute that the district court applied the correct factors under EasySaver, the three factors, which we of course now acknowledge are the law of the circuit, but we do dispute that because we dispute that we argue that the district court applied an improper factor, just as the EasySaver district court did. If you look at record 43, ER 43, the district court was relying on the fact the class members have expressed interest in the defendant's products for considering it a coupon. But that's exactly the factor that EasySaver rejected as being a relevant factor for whether something is a coupon. EasySaver said, even assuming the district court was correct, that this settlement was specifically tailored to the harm suffered and the interest they had in receiving a discount off a future purchase, it does not follow that the full face value of all the $20 credit should be used. Regardless of the substance of the underlying claim or injury, CAFA prevents settling parties from valuing coupons at face value without accounting for their redemption rate. And then it continues in footnote 6, to the extent the settling parties are correct that class members have a strong interest in receiving these coupons, the coupon redemption rate should reflect that interest. So it is an abuse of discretion to consider an improper factor. The court's the standard of the test is reviewed de novo. It's a question of law, and our view is that the three-prong test should be viewed as a checklist. Each must be satisfied to realize to be construed as a non-coupon under EasySaver and online DVD. Otherwise, I don't see how, if it's a balancing test that gives full discretion, unlimited discretion to the district courts, I don't see how this case can be reconciled with the EasySaver decision. If that was the case, EasySaver would have had to affirm that the district court's conclusion that the vouchers in that, the credits in that case were not CAFA coupons. But of course it didn't.
Does the record reflect how many of this $10 million in vouchers have in fact been claimed?
So what the structure of the settlement, I believe something around 3 million were claimed, and then because of the structure, they were augmented to 10 million.
Right. But I mean, do we know how many of that has in fact been claimed at this point?
We do not know how many of that has been redeemed, which is the relevant question, right, in our view.
Yeah, right. Redeemed is what I'm asking.
Exactly. Yeah, those won't be sent out until the effective date. Those are sent out on the voucher date, which is 2 months after the effective date. And then at that point, class members have 16 months to redeem them. They expire. Unlike the gift cards in online DVD, which were not expirable, They were a cash equivalent. Mr. Kashima wants to distinguish the economic reality cases because in those cases, a pot of money was made available and then not claimed. But if you look at Rose, it's very clear economic reality has to take into account not only what is claimed, but what is likely to be redeemed.
And the problem was there that the district court valued the face value, notwithstanding that parts were unclaimed and would go unredeemed, and then those that would go unredeemed would be reverted. I'm sorry if I interrupted you there, Judge Gilman.
No, that's okay. Isn't it 18 months they have?
Well, they have 18 months. So this was the confusion. It was 18 months from the effective date, but the voucher date that they'll get it is 2 months after that. So they have 16 months from getting it. The characterization of Mr. Boutros that we asked this court to reject the three-factor test is not correct. We ask for a legal interpretation of the three-factor test that's consistent with how Easy Saver applied the test. If you look at the district court's decision, the district court is relying on the unpublished Hendricks decision, which we don't think it's consistent with that language at 956 of Easy Saver that says that the expression of interest doesn't matter to whether something is a coupon or not. It matters to, at the end of the day, what their redemption rate will be and what fees can be awarded based on that. But it doesn't matter to the threshold question. The threshold question of whether it is a coupon. Mr. Boutros also accuses us of wanting to just focus on one factor, the allocational factor between the attorney's fees and the class payment, and that's only one factor amongst the 23E factors. But the 23E factors made explicit Bluetooth, and Bluetooth says that in a pre-certification context like you have here, reliance on the Churchill factors, exhausting the Churchill factors is not sufficient to approve the settlement. You have to look at the question of allocation. It's not enough that the total settlement amount is adequate in light of the weaknesses, the risks of further litigation. And that's what Mr. Boutros wants to get into. But that's not sufficient. And Bluetooth makes that clear. That's this court's interpretation in Briseño post the 2018 amendments. So it's bizarre to view the 2018 amendments, which make that concern explicit, as somehow limiting it or making it more generous to settling parties in the approval of their settlement. And I don't think that's a good rule that this court should lay down.
Counsel, if I may interject a question. How do you respond to the argument by Mr. Boutros that if we think there's some problem with the attorney fees, we should approve the settlement in the aggregate and just remand for discussion or reassessment on the attorney fees?
The problem there is that the class would lose that amount of money of reduction. The fee reduction, which is part of the constructive common fund, it was negotiated. It was a clear sailing agreement that $3.3 million would be unopposed. It is then reverting to the defendant. Unless the parties agree to renegotiate that reversion, the class cannot access the money. And that is the problem of a fee reversion in the first place.
Right, but as Judge Gould is pointing out, though, if we revert, send it back on that, the judge may decide that $600,000 maybe should go to the class rather than back to the massaging.
I don't think that under the terms of the settlement, the district court is allowed to do that. I think it has to give a thumbs up or thumbs down to the settlement. And under the terms of the settlement, the $600,000 goes back to Massage Envy. So I don't think I believe the case is Evans v. Jeff D. or something like that. The district court doesn't have that authority. If there are no further questions, I'll stand on the briefs.
I have no questions. Judge Gilman, Judge Miller. Hearing no questions, I think... this will conclude the argument. Now, let me just say, again, we appreciate all three of your counsel showing up for remote arguments. and handling it in this period. You're also all to be commended for excellent advocacy in the highest traditions of the bar. So the panel will now submit the Drobnis v. McKinney, Drobnis v. Massage Envy franchising case, and the parties will hear from us in due course. And the court will now take a 10 to 15 minute recess.
Thank you.